So thank you very much for inviting me. And one of the things I'll do is talk about what we've learned in health and healthcare. And I just want to make sure that you don't discount it and say, oh, that's health and healthcare, that's not us, because it's really something that's happening all over as far as I can see. So what I'm going to do is talk briefly, very briefly, about systematic reviews and meta-analysis for those of you who may want that refresher. And then I'm going to talk about the work of the Cochrane Collaboration. How many people here have heard of systematic reviews and meta-analysis? How about the Cochrane Collaboration? And how many people feel really secure about what the Cochrane Collaboration does? That's good. Maybe more. So I'll talk a little bit about that, but not in technical terms, more how we put the data out there for other people to access. And then I'm going to talk about why there's such a push for open access to research data in healthcare and the health field. And then finally, I'm just going to present how we are hoping that systematic reviews will be used for the guidelines in how we practice healthcare. And some of this is working really well and some less well. So it's not easy, and don't get discouraged. So you all know, whatever the field is, that reviews are essential. Basically, in all of our fields, my guess is that research is presented in short published papers. We have lots of incentives for us each to publish these papers and to get grants, and that doesn't necessarily square well with what we do. And so that's the challenge. This literature is huge. I don't know about your literature, but we have well over 22,000 medical journals now, and there's just no way you can keep up with it. I have various means for trying to keep up with the literature, but where I used to be pretty good, I'm embarrassed now that I really don't keep up with it, even relying on my graduate students. And even though we have ways of indexing the literature, that's not the same as organizing literature. So at least our literature is not well organized, and I don't know that it's going to be. So we have to do some organization ourselves. So we have to have some sort of reviews. We can't possibly read everything that's out there. It's information overload. It's not organized, and so we rely on reviews. Now, the trouble is that the reviews can be cherry-picked. And so this idea that, now I'm going to look for a pointer. Maybe I'll use the, sometimes I switch the slides though when I use that. So there are reviews that are out there that are in the past. I don't know what they're like in your field, but they sell a lot of journals. They're great to read, but they're not systematic. You don't have any sureness that what's being presented is everything that's out there. It could be cherry-picked information. And within all reviews, there's something called a systematic review that uses the same methods we have in the rest of science, a methods section, a results section, a discussion section for how this literature was identified and then what it showed. And there is, of course, expert opinion in there, just in setting the eligibility criteria for which literature you're going to look at, what your study question is. But by making it transparent, the idea is at least people will know if you have left something out, why you've left it out. And then within the systematic reviews, sometimes there's enough data in each of the papers or some of the papers that you identify that you can do what's called a meta-analysis, and that's a quantitative synthesis of the data that are out there. And you want to get an average effect, because I don't know about you, but with our studies in health, you need that average effect, because depending on the population and the exact question examined, you can get quite disparate estimates of the effect. And so the average effect is very useful. And that's called a meta-analysis. So the systematic review, and within that, the meta-analysis. So to have a meta-analysis, you have to have a systematic review. But a systematic review doesn't have to have a meta-analysis. Now here's that the graphic that was shown. So we start with evidence generation. That's our original primary studies. In health, when we're looking at the effects of an intervention, it's typically a randomized clinical trial. And I know you have randomized clinical trials in agriculture as well, but it doesn't have to be. You can do a systematic review of anything, of etiology, of what causes cause and effect with a clinical trial, or you can look at what are the adverse effects, et cetera. The prognosis, what happens if you do this or that, and those are called observational studies. And the evidence synthesis is the systematic review. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Cochrane Collaboration that does these systematic reviews. Then from the systematic reviews, we get guidelines. And these are recommendations by higher level bodies that might be the County Extension Service, it might be some other higher level group that you're used to dealing with. But then the trick is not just what's the advice, but is it implemented? So a new design for tractor rollovers, for example, might be recommended, but if you're using your grandfather's tractor, it doesn't mean you necessarily implement it. So that application of policy, the three overlapping circles there, that's trickier to get. In healthcare, that represents the evidence, the clinician expertise and knowledge, and what the patient brings, what you all bring as patients to the question. You may not want to do what's being recommended for various reasons, for comorbidities that you or your family have. If you've dealt with an elderly parent, maybe based on what's just happened to them, an ordinary prediction would be, oh, they should have a bypass. But they're 95 years old. Maybe that's not what you choose because of the values about the rest of life and how you want to see it lived. So we're going to concentrate here on this part, the evidence synthesis, and towards the end I'm going to talk a little bit about guidelines or recommendations. So it turns out that everybody's doing evidence-based something now. And if you just do a Google search, it's amazing what's out there. You can even find evidence-based antiques, I think, which I have no idea what that is, but it's out there. So a lot has happened in health, and it's interesting that we're looked at as ahead of the game. I think the Cochrane Collaboration has made a big impact, but really, a lot of this work started in psychology and education. They aren't necessarily where we are now in health, but it's where everything started. In education, there's something called the What Works Clearinghouse, and the U.S. Department of Education puts that out. It's all the studies that have been done and systematic reviews of the evidence. And believe me, there's a lot of pushback on having that What Works Clearinghouse because the manufacturers of different math books, for example, for primary grades, may not want the actual tests out there. Dietary guidelines, you may have read about some of the pushback on the dietary guidelines, again, because lobbyists are pushing Congress to change what the systematic reviews have shown. The environmental toxins, a lot of pushback from Congress because of what they're getting from the lobbyists about the effects of arsenic, formaldehyde, whatever. What is the safe level? So it's an interaction between the systematic reviews and then the lobbyists, but at least we have the systematic reviews, pretty hard to fight, and of course in agronomy. So there's a lot of evidence-based something happening, and that's the way we like it. It should be based on all that research we've been doing. So the Cochrane Collaboration is an international group that has a website, www.cochrane.org, and what their main output of the Cochrane Collaboration is systematic reviews in health and healthcare, all kinds of systematic reviews. And you can access this and find out more about Cochrane for free. The Cochrane Collaboration produces systematic reviews, as I said. So when this started more than 20 years ago, and what happened is that Ian Chalmers, who's an Englishman and he's somewhere in this mix of people, he called together his friends, basically from around the world, 70 people, 9 countries. Everyone, you know, got to this meeting on their own dime, in their own time. And what he said is, let's pull together all the evidence in all of health and healthcare and do systematic reviews and meta-analysis and make it available. And the goal was to do it for free. That hasn't been possible so far, but we're going to try to do it by 2020. I'd say it was the original crowdsourcing, because it was largely based, and still is largely based, on volunteers who do this work. So there are now over 30,000 people, probably about 37,000 contributors, who either do the systematic reviews or are peer reviewers, and they come from 130 countries around the world. Although English is the main language, the Cochrane reviews now are being translated into multiple languages. We have over 6,000 completed systematic reviews in the Cochrane Library, and probably another 2,000 to 3,000 that are in what's called the protocol stage, and they're kept up to date. So depending on the priority of the question being addressed, sometimes they're updated yearly, sometimes I have a review, for example, that now is being archived because the question just is no longer relevant. Everyone believes the evidence, and that's the end of story. There's no new evidence emerging, and doctors aren't using the treatment anymore. So it depends on the question whether these reviews are updated often, less often, or not at all. So the Cochrane Library is the main output of the Cochrane Collaboration, and this is a subscription. It's paid for almost certainly by any university with which you're associated with. And in the US, those subscription costs apply because we're one of the main users, and I think people see us as able to afford it. That said, over half of the world gets the Cochrane Library for free because it is given for free to low and middle income countries. And some countries pay for a subscription for the entire country. The US does not. But the Cochrane Library, you can get some things for free. You can get the abstracts and the lay summaries for free. So you don't have to read all 200 pages of the review showing all the data if you don't want to. So I'm just going to show you now, this is the Cochrane.org website. And the Cochrane Library has more than just the reviews on it. It also has like a journal club. It has information about each of the topics. You can browse either by topic or by specific question. And it's updated daily, so it doesn't have a regular publication schedule. It's the modern way. It's online. You can get a CD version if you're in a country that doesn't have good internet, but for the most part now we're entirely internet. So you can search the Cochrane Library using relevant terms. Here I just put in the term diet to see what I get. And you can see, down here, it has all those fill-ins. Let's see. There. So diet fad, diet record, dietary fat, et cetera. And I can put in what I want. But I just put in diet, and so got a variety of reviews. This is a review on exercise for improving balance in older people, and it's my only slide really where I'm going to show you what's in the Cochrane Library. We aren't going to spend a lot of time on how the reviews are done, but what they contain. So usually a typical review, you would call what's called registering the title. You'd go to one of the review groups and I say, I want to do a review on exercise for improving balance in older people. You have to have probably more than two people because you need subject matter experts as well as methodologic experts and others. And this particular one goes to the bone, joint, and muscle trauma group. And then in doing the review, after you register the protocol, which is how you're going to do it, what's your question, where are you going to search, and then you actually do the review. And the protocol is peer-reviewed. Once it's published, the protocol is published, you go in, do your review, and with an information scientist, you do a search for relevant papers. And that search is published so everybody can see how you did it. And each Cochrane group has its own informationist who helps you get a good search. And how those searches are done is based on science and studies we've done of searching. So every step is really based on methods that have a strong foundation scientifically. So then your review will have a record of how many records you identified, in this case nearly 4,000, and which databases you searched, and then how many were screened and duplicates are removed. And then in the end, 75 studies were included in the systematic review. And then you have meta-analyses for each outcome that you examined. So as you can see, even though 75 studies were identified, only four examined this outcome, which is the timed up and go test. And so that's an interesting topic we'll come back later to, is why don't they all measure the outcomes we're interested in? So here you have each individual study. So Belling, McGarry, Schilling, and Brandsatis. And here are the results in terms of the meta-analysis, where this is a risk difference. So a zero means no difference between the intervention group and the comparison group. And then this green square is the point estimate of effect. These are the 95% confidence intervals, and the diamond is the summary effect. And the 95% confidence interval extends between the two points, the horizontal points of the diamond. So you can see this is a statistically significant benefit. Okay, favoring exercise in older people for their balance, something you should go home and tell your parents or grandparents. And then there's also a risk of bias assessment, which is each study that's in the systematic review has its risk of bias estimated. Remember, there were 75 studies, regardless of outcome, and each element of bias is assessed by the reviewers, reading and assessing each of the studies. So not only are the results of each study extracted, but also how the study was done and whether we think there's a likelihood of bias. So red means bad, and yellow means can't tell, might be good, might be bad, but they just didn't say in their article, and green means good. So you can look down and see, and I'm not sure what it is, to be honest, I can't read it, that very few of the studies did very well on this one particular element of risk of bias. Oops, sorry. I'm sorry, I don't have a pointer here, so I just have that little pointer. So that's a typical Cochrane review right there. I've just showed you some of the elements, and I happen to like figures the best, better than words, but there are plenty of words, depending on what you like. So one of the big questions is, well, we want Cochrane to be considered the most trustworthy source of evidence for people who are making recommendations. How can we assure that? And so constantly, over the 23 years since the beginning of Cochrane, we've aimed to make our reviews the best possible. We have different methods groups working on the methods of the reviews and so forth. For example, there's a new risk of bias tool that's just coming out. So the first thing is, how can we assure that our reviews are trustworthy? So I think one of the biggest issues has to do with how the results of studies are reported. And so this has led Cochrane to make a move that all studies that they would use be what's called open access. That is, anybody can look at the data and the metadata and examine them. So let's just look inside the hood now and see, okay, we can present a very nice meta-analysis, but is that the whole story? And I'll tell you, it's not the whole story, because as everyone's worried, there's a lot of ice below the surface. You may have the nice iceberg showing and telling you where you can steer your ship, but there's a lot of stuff under the surface that we really can't see. And it's a lot of information about what really happened in these studies. Some of it is you can't even use because of the format it's in, and a lot of it is unpublished, and you've got to figure out how to look for it. So some of the problems with bad publication practices are that the information isn't published at all. It's not published, and that would be okay if it was not published in a random way, but what if what isn't published is, for example, negative results? So what if, worst case scenario, what is published is all the positive results showing a benefit of an intervention? So we may think that aspirin prevents heart attack, but in fact there are a whole bunch of negative studies out there that are unpublished, and we have no way of knowing this. So we're all taking one aspirin a day, thinking it's going to prevent heart attack, and maybe there's unpublished data. I'm just making that up, so don't stop your aspirin. So there can also be a delayed publication, that is, that negative results are published in a much more slow fashion than positive results. So when we look at first, it looks like something's really beneficial, but it's not. There can be incomplete publication. Remember I showed you the exercise for balance in older people, that even though there are 75 studies that examine this issue, only four of them look at a particular outcome, and that's absolutely typical of what you find, is that there's a lot of incomplete publication with what's called selective outcome reporting. But you can also have missing detail of the methods. You can have plenty of systematic reviews without the risk of bias data that I showed you. And finally, there can just be out and out right misreporting, some of it lying and some of it a mistake. So the biggest issue that we have is called reporting bias, which, as I said, is a tendency to prepare and submit and publish findings based on their results, either the strength of the findings or the actual findings themselves, whether they're statistically significant, or it could be that it's the researchers are from Russia and the journal doesn't like Russian writers. They only like people who are native English speakers. So there can be all sorts of reasons that there's a publication, a reporting bias. Here's an example of a sort of ad hoc systematic review of different studies that have looked at studies that started, they were initiated, and then were they published at all? So there are all sorts of studies in here from ethics committees that came through ethics committees or were funded by the NIH, or and all over the world. It could be Canada or Finland, it could be France, et cetera. And what you see is this huge range of percent published. That at a Barcelona hospital IRB, only about 20% of all initiated studies that came through the IRB were published. Well, if you look at NIH trials, 93% of them were published. So there is a variation, and people think that about 50% of all initiated studies are published. So maybe that wouldn't be worrisome unless, as I said before, there's a reporting bias and people selectively publish their positive over their negative results. So this is one of many systematic reviews looking at publication bias, and it's just studies that looked at positive versus negative or null findings, looking at a particular cohort of studies. And here there are six studies. You can see they had similar results and an odds ratio of about three, that is that positive results are more likely to be published than negative or null results. That's a Cochrane review. So what are we going to do about this? We know it's a problem, and I'll tell you the end, which is we've worked on many fronts, but I don't think we've solved the problem of reporting biases yet. And that's why we're moving to open access of data. So one of the things that people have worked on a lot in Cochrane is reporting guidelines. And so we have, how do you report clinical trials? How do you report systematic reviews of clinical trials, systematic reviews of observational studies? How do you report observational studies? And there are tons of reporting guidelines now. And I would say this has been a huge help. Not all journals adhere to reporting guidelines, and even when they say they do, they don't necessarily. But at least it gets the report having more information so you can judge the quality of the study and what they found for your systematic review. You can also try to find out, you know, well, how many studies were there? Even if we don't know what the results were, let's at least get a full deck and we know that there were 100 studies out there, only 50 of which were published. We may not know what the other 50 showed in terms of their results, but at least we know we're missing 50. And that in the US has really happened through clinicaltrials.gov. How many of you have ever heard of or used clinicaltrials.gov? So it doesn't have to be just clinical trials. It also has observational studies. And it really took a couple of things to make this happen, because clinicaltrials.gov has been in existence a long time, but I can see very few of you know what it is or have used it, and maybe there's something like it in agronomy, I'm not sure, but it's made a huge difference. And it means that we theoretically have a full deck of what's out there. In fact, we don't have everything that's out there, and that's probably because in academia, I would say that our deans are less supportive than they might be about registering studies. But what made this more effective, in addition to having a law and some penalties if you don't do it, which have never been applied, is that the journal said, the big journal said, we aren't going to take the papers unless the studies have been registered. And that probably made a bigger impact on registration of studies than anything else that we can say to scientists. So it's when you involve groups like your journal editors that you start making a difference. You've just got to work on all fronts because you never know what's going to work. So some of you may have read in your newspaper about Tamiflu, which is a pill. It's not a shot for influenza. And what happened is the U.S. started stockpiling Tamiflu in case there was an influenza outbreak. And so for the Cochrane Review, the group looked at internal company files as well as what was published about Tamiflu. And what they found is that the publications didn't represent what was known at all. And hardly anyone has this information, although now it's made public. And so there were a different number of trials done on how well Tamiflu works than what was published, and they found this out, that adverse events associated with taking this pill were not reported, and they weren't always called adverse events. Sometimes they were called complications, so that people didn't look there necessarily to see how many adverse events were associated. There was a huge time delay in publication when trials were published, and that had to do with the results. And the details you really couldn't find in what was published. You had to go to what are called the clinical study reports. And they're about, you know, they can be 8,000 pages long. They're really hard to wade through, but that can be where the complete data are. So a lot of information can be missed if you just rely on the publication. And I know from working with some other fields that people don't think this is a problem in their own field, but I would doubt that it's only true in medicine. I think you just have to start looking and find ways to look. So there are a lot of studies now that what we see in publications isn't, in fact, what was done. There are surveys from authors about what actually happened. People have looked at clinicaltrials.gov and compared what's there with what's in the publication, and they don't agree. People have compared what was sent to FDA with the publication, and they don't agree. And we don't have details in the FDA because it's not public information, but we have the summary information, and it doesn't agree. And then in a few cases, we have internal company documents, and we've been able to compare those to publications, like the Tamiflu example I showed you, and shown that they don't agree. And so people are concerned about this. There's a real reporting bias. Many reporting biases operating, and what's in the publication, in fact, doesn't represent what's known. And for this reason, people are asking for open access to data. Easier said than done. These are some of the clinical trials, what I'm dealing in, some of the sources of information that are out there, and they don't all agree. We know that. So we're doing a study that we call MUDS, because it's pretty muddy, where we're actually just looking at two drugs for two specific indications, gabapentin for neuropathic pain and quetiapine for bipolar depression. And then we're comparing the results you would get in a meta-analysis depending on which source of information you use. And the study isn't done yet, so we don't know what we're going to find. But, you know, let's say best case scenario, we find no effective difference. We predict that we will find there are some systematic differences based on what other people found, especially with adverse events. We think they tend not to be reported. Others have found that. And we published one paper on this, which is we asked the manufacturers for the data because the manufacturers have advertised that they provide open access to data. And in fact, over a year's time, we never got the data, even though they advertise that they provide the data. So I think sometimes this promise of what they'll do is advertising and may not be what in fact happens. So what does Cochrane do about this? Well, there's no solution, as I said. There are some rules. You have to say, you know, which trials have not reported results, and then what's the waste? How many patients have contributed data to these trials and then they're not published, the information? And then we have to publish the names of individuals that are withholding data, and we try to make an effort to get the data, writing and asking for it. So because many groups now have committed to supplying their data from their particular studies to data repositories, there's actually a registry of repositories. But I will say one of our frustrations is there are numerous repositories, and so it's even hard to keep track of where all the data are, and they're in all different formats. There are no standards. So, for example, this is just the sex of who was in each study. There are many different ways. This could be kept in a database. So it could be male, female, it could be MF, it could be 01, it could be 12. So we all keep data in a different way. There are no real standards. And so even if we have open access to data, it doesn't mean that it's going to be easy. So just in the last minute or two, I want to say, well, how can we be sure we're making an impact? So I presented some problems, but we have to keep going. I mean, doctors are going to be suggesting specific care to us, whether there's a reporting bias or not. They need to act on what is known or we think we know. But how are we making sure we're not just putting those reviews out there and they're not making an impact? And in fact, that's our biggest challenge, I would say. The Institute of Medicine a couple of years ago put out two studies, one about how to do a systematic review properly in healthcare, and also the National Research Council now has one on how to do it in toxicology. So this helps. People do pay attention. And then with this Standards for Systematic Reviews, the companion study was how to build clinical practice guidelines then that we can trust. And what it says is it has to be based on systematic reviews that are done well. And the guidelines, people have to be unconflicted and so forth. So these are really companions, the data and acting on the data. So I'll just give you an example, a brief example of what we're doing with ophthalmology and optometry. We're working with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. They have 23 practice guidelines. And so our Cochrane reviews then, the reviewers are looking, taking the guidelines one by one and saying how often do they depend on systematic reviews the way the Institute of Medicine said that they should. So first of all, the systematic reviews that are out there aren't all Cochrane. Probably only about 20% of systematic reviews are Cochrane. It's seen as a way to get a quick publication. In fact, any kind of review takes a long time and a lot of effort. But there are a lot of bad systematic reviews out there. And so what we do is a quality assessment of all the systematic reviews we've identified that address the questions in a particular guideline. As you can see, no is dark, and not reported is white, and not applicable is light blue. So most of these systematic reviews aren't that good. That's the bottom line. Some are good, but some fields are actually quite good, but I would say they're not all good. So you have to look at the quality of the systematic reviews that are out there, because just because a review is done by a group you think is trustworthy, if you're the guidelines group, you aren't necessarily just going to look at reviews by that group, and that makes sense. So what we do for each guideline is we take the 45 questions or 50 questions or 40 questions or 55 that have been addressed in the guidelines. So what we do is we take their recommendations and we turn them around to a question. And so we say, well, for that question, how many systematic reviews are out there? And then we survey a professional society related to that review and say, all right, now here are the questions for which there are no systematic reviews or low-quality systematic reviews. Which are the priority ones? And those are the ones we'll do the systematic reviews for first. And so we did this. This is an example from open-angle glaucoma. But you can see we work with different over here we have the different professional societies that we've worked with and the surveys that we've done for open-angle glaucoma, primary angle closure glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy, age-related macular degeneration, dry eye syndrome. And those are the guidelines that we've started out with. And we did surveys, usually Delphi surveys. So all in all, there's still lots to do. Cochrane Collaboration has been going 23 years. I'm the director of the U.S. Cochrane Center, and I would say in my building at Johns Hopkins alone, they don't get it that we're all over the world, and they go back to England with questions, and I'm two floors above them. It's very frustrating. So there's even a misunderstanding about the work we do and where, you know, where we're situated versus the group as a whole. So we are doing our best, and I think succeeding at being a trustworthy source of information and data synthesis, but the data are a problem. The data availability is a problem, and so we're working to try to make open access to all data. And then we want to make sure that the data are used also and have an impact on how we practice health and healthcare. Thank you.